in a slightly strange way, as you will see, since about 11 years ago. And I've been going to Chicago for over 20 years because I did my PhD in Wisconsin, not very far away, so it was the big city to visit. And there was a book that came out, I can't remember exactly when, called Chicago's Perfect Cities, written by a guy called Patrick Gilbert, in which he outlined four or five attempts to produce urban utopias in Chicago, including the White City at the Chicago World's Fair and the Pullman model workers' town. And being kind of cantankerous about such things, I thought that it would be a good idea to write the opposite and write a book on Chicago's sort of imperfect places. And I had a series of places, one of which was Maxwell Street Market. And that's what I ended up getting so interested in, I dropped the rest of it. And I've been going backwards and forwards to the archives in Chicago for quite a long time now in order to write this book, which is outlined here. And the point of this book is to engage with a particular place so as creatively as possible within the remit of being an academic geographer. This particular presentation isn't going to show the most creative side of what I'm doing, but hopefully when the book's written, which I'm in the process of doing, it will be written as in a way which is more in common with creative nonfiction than academic texts. Part of the object of it, though, and which will happen at the end rather than the beginning of the book, is this attempt at rethinking place. Not to completely demolish everything that's gone before and start anew, because that would be foolhardy, but to take discussions of place forward, theoretically, beyond a distinction between a Heideggerian sense of place, which is becoming more fashionable after its years in the wastelands as a sense of belonging and rootedness and dwelling, and on the other hand, the more contemporary political engagement with place associated with Dorian Massey and the progressive sense of place as a node of mobility, as a place related to everything else. And so, I take both of those on board and take it forward in a particular way. So part of my project is that, and part of my project is a creative engagement with one place over 100 years. And this is more or less the structure of the book. And the bits in bold are the bits I'm going to talk a bit about today. So I'm going to talk a bit about planning documents and maps, which I think you will agree is one of the least exciting of the things I've listed there, but will become more exciting, hopefully, as we go through the next 45 minutes. And also a little bit about the theoretical substance, which in this case I'm going to do at the beginning rather than the end. So I want to start with two quotes that get to the heart of some of the issues that I'm interested in. If I can work this machine. Which side was it, right or left?
Left.
I'm doing left. There we go. Here's some components of a theory of place that I'm working on. So locatedness or here-ness, this idea of a particular space, a particular place that has, if you like, a vertical axis running through it, connecting us to location. And the second point, the connectedness, which is a horizontal, think about a place as a coming together of a vertical and horizontal axis. So the idea of place as a coming together place, a gathering place, something that gathers things together from outside of it. And then to think about three aspects of place, things, representations, and practices, which I think of as the kinds of things that gather in place. So things do, objects do, representations, narratives, stories, ideologies even, and practices, the things people do that become place-based in some way, all of which happened in this marketplace I'm going to talk about. And then to think a bit about how places endure temporality. How does one place become another place over time? And I want to think about that in relation to these three things, representations, and practices. What are the temporalities of these three? And how does one place produce path dependency, whatever you want to call it, that makes the next place 10 years later, 20 years later, 100 years later, possible or impossible? And to continue to think about power, as I've done through my career, how power is implicated in all of this, in how things are connected, in where things are, in how one place becomes another place over time. So this is the first quote I want to talk about. John Berger from And Our Faces, My Heart Brief as Photos. Home was the centre of the world because it was the place where a vertical line crossed with a horizontal line. The vertical line was a path leading upwards to the sky and downwards to the underworld. The horizontal line represented the traffic of the world, all the possible roads leading across the earth to other places. Thus, at home, one was nearest to the gods in the sky and the dead in the underworld. This nearness promised access to both. And at the same time, one was at the starting point, and hopefully the returning point, of all terrestrial journeys. So think of home as place here, which often is, you know, home as an ideal kind of place. And you'll see the start of this idea of places forming as formed on this crossroads of two axes, a vertical axis and a horizontal axis. But it's simply a site of both roots and roots, as well, we constantly say in place talk. It's a cliche. A similar point is made by another wonderful writer, Rebecca Solnit, when she suggests that it was place that taught her to write when confronted with the Nevada nuclear test site. During protests she participated in, she was faced with both a space literally surrounded by barbed wire, neat and clearly territorial, and a place marked by the convergence of nuclear science, attitudes to the desert, and the protesters from all over the world. Maybe, she wrote, the first lesson was that the very term place is problematic, implying a discrete entity, something you could put a fence around. What we mean by place is a crossroads, a particular point of intersection of forces coming from many directions and distances. So again, there's that sense of a horizontal plane in which places is a known with connections. So these two quotes resonate with the contemporary concerns of the interdisciplinary interest in place, particularly geography following Doreen Massey, who have been developing a relational approach to place that emphasises the horizontal flows over and above the vertical axis of roots, boundedness, attachment and belonging. This, of course, a challenge what we think of as the conventional way of thinking about place as singular and particular, a tightly or loosely defined portion of space that has accumulated particular meanings at both the level of the individual and the social. This is the classic definition provided by Yifu Tuan, a place is a field of care and sense of meaning. So Tuan places, I'll get used to this thing. Okay. I missed it already. How do I go back? Do you know how I get back? Tuan's place is a pause in the wider world of space, which in his terms is a more abstract field of action. So he writes, space is a common symbol of freedom in the Western world. Space lies open. It suggests the future and invites action. On the negative side, space and freedom are a threat. The root meaning of the word bad is open. To be open and free is to be exposed and vulnerable. Open space has no trodden paths and signposts, has no fixed pattern or established human meaning. It is like a blank sheet on which meaning may be imposed. Enclosed and humanized space is place. Compared to space, place is calm, center of established values. Human beings require both space and place. Human lives are a dialectical movement between shelter and venture, attachment and freedom. But thinking about place obviously didn't begin with Tuan, even in geography. There's still a still longer tradition of thinking of places as unique, syncretic gatherings of things that need to be understood in situ. This is a tradition of chorology that marked much of the first half of the 20th century in the discipline that I work in. So in this guise, Richard Hartshorne interprets the realities of aerial differentiation of the world as they are found not only in terms of the differences of thing from place to place, but also in terms of the total combination of phenomena in each place, different from those at every other place. It was geography's task then, and if those of you not in geography, this is a kind of key moment in geography, Hartshorne's early part of the 20th century discussion of regions and places. It was geography's task, therefore, to provide a synthesis of relevant information It describes and accounts for the differences between one place, or region, and another. At the heart of this exercise of synthesis lay regional geography, or borrowing from the Greek, chorology. Hartshorne used the idea of the region to make a case for geography's exceptionalism. While most disciplines have a formal object of study, he argued, geography's purpose was synthetic. It involved the totality of things found in a particular region or place. While history was a study of specific times, geography was a study of particular regions or places. What this study involved was how the specific and the particular gathered things and attributes together in ways which made them unique. This was a view underlined by many geographers up until the 1960s. It's often given as one of the core definitions of geography, such as the one I learned as an undergraduate. That which geography, in exchange for the help it's received from other sciences, can bring to the common treasury is the capacity not to break apart what nature has assembled, to understand the correspondence and correlation of things, whether in the setting of the whole surface of the earth or in the regional setting where things are localized. This emphasis on place as a singular collection of things in the natural and human worlds travelled hand in hand with a focus on the vertical axis of rootedness and belonging. Such approaches are, of course, are indebted to Heidegger and his insistence on the processes through which people become rooted. This sense of rootedness is achieved through being in place, building and dwelling. Heidegger's famous log cabin in the Black Forest links him to the cosmos and to the earth as nature. The important axis in his work is the vertical one. This view is changed slightly by the important work of the philosopher Edward Cayce, who's insisted on place and space as points in which things are gathered, gathering points. Memory, he argues, amongst other things, is a process of gathering things together, of giving them a location. For this reason, he argues, memory is strongly tied to and possibly dependent on place. When you think about many ways in which we talk to memorise things, often it's through walking through a building, for instance. So the route of the word stanza in poetry is a room. You kind of go from room to room, and certain mnemonic devices are about thinking about memories in terms of spatial arrangement. Places are where things, but also memories, emotions, discourses, etc., gather. This suggests a horizontal action of drawing in things from the outside, a relation between an inside that gathers and an outside from which things are gathered. It also suggests a constant dynamic sense of things on the move that are gathered in place, often very temporarily. Which brings us to the writing, of course, of Doreen Massey on place and space as relational concepts, focusing our attention on a horizontal plane of connections and networks. To understand any place, she argues, we have to look toward the lines in and out of town that connect this place to other places and thereby constitute it. This is as true of rocks as it is of people and commodities. So in an evocative essay on the mountain of Skiddaw in the Lake District, she notes how though these rocks, the rocks of Skiddaw, were formed thousands of miles away and millions of years ago, south of the equator. One way in which people make claims to the permanence and essential qualities of place is often through recourse to nature, and particularly to rocks. This happens in bioregionalism, for instance, the tradition associated with Gary Snyder and others in the US. By recounting the ability of rocks, Massey undermined these arguments, pointing out that even the supposedly natural landscape is made up of trajectories, of relations between inside and outside, and writes that maybe instead of, or as well as, the time embeddedness, the idea of place as being sort of embedded, the dwelling idea of Heidegger, that the relational achievement of the establishment of the provisional ground, such histories, like the histories of rocks and of interconnections, push a need to rethink our security. Certainly such histories have the potential to be read as removing the absoluteness of such grounding, the certainty of place. So that all we are left with is our interdependence, a kind of suspended, constantly being made interdependence, human and beyond human. So Massey's interventions then have marked a transformation from thinking of place vertically as rooted in time immemorial to thinking of it horizontally as produced relationally through connections. Such a notion of place, rather than being introverted and reactionary, in her words, is extroverted and vertically hopeful. As she notes above, or over there, it forces us to think in terms of interdependence rather than insular identities. It's a relational conception of place. But of course, what gets lost in a relational approach to place is this very specificity of here-ness. The here-ness that resists or attracts particular kinds of flows and relations. So I want to balance the vertical and horizontal. And here I find the work of the political geographer Martin Jones particularly useful. He does not completely contradict relational ways of thinking about space and scale, but instead insists on the continuing salience of territory and region and place in the ongoing work of politics. He sees the relational argument as setting up a straw person argument of territory, place and region as static concepts that need to be replaced. In fact, he suggests political actors continually assume space to be formed territorially and act as though it is. These territories, he argues, are being made and remade all the time through political, economic and cultural practice. Similarly, networks, the favoured spatial form of many relational thinkers, are not always fluid and dynamic, but have their own fairly static components or nodes, roots and moorings. Another question raised by Jones and others related to the often poorly specified nature of relations that make up space or place. What are these relations? What is it that's being related? How come some things, places, are rich in relations while others are relationally impoverished? Who gets to make things relate? Is anything non-relational? Jones suggests that there may even be structural reasons why some things enter into relations and others do not. At the core of Jones' argument is the necessity of taking temporality into account when thinking through the interrelations between relational space and forms of territory and region. He uses the notion of phase space, which he borrows from physics. Phase space describes the way in which one set of spatial possibilities leads, or does not lead, to a new arrangement of space at some future point. Space, he argues, is sticky, and things can get stuck or anchored in it. This shapes the unfolding of space and society over time through a familiar interaction of structure, that is institutions, imperatives, etc., and agency, that is individual acts. So he writes, socio-spatial relations are deeply processual and practical outcomes of strategic initiatives undertaken by a wide range of forces produced neither through structural determinism, and you can see Anthony Giddens in here somewhere, nor through a spontaneous volunteerism, but through a mutually transformative evolution of inherited spatial structures and emergent spatial strategies. Within an actively differentiated, continually evolving grid of institutions, territories, and regulatory activities. I think if that was an undergraduate essay, I would have split the sentences up at some point. In short, constructed and always emergent space matters in shaping future trajectories. Phase space describes the observation that present spatial arrangements contain within them a multitude of possibilities for futures, different versions of what happens next. It also reintroduces a space of boundedness and territory in a terrain which relational theorists are attempting to dissolve completely. It involves conceding that there may be certain circumstances in which, as an object of analysis, practical and bounded spaces have been institutionalized through cracked particular struggles and become identified as discrete territories in the sphere of economics, politics, and culture matter. My final foray into a theory of place today, before I go on to talk about Maxwell Street a bit, involves the increasingly fashionable pastime known as assemblage theory. Now, this is most often associated with Deleuze and Guattari, and has been developed by Manuel de Landa, but could be applied, I believe, retrospectively to much of the history of geography. In fact, what Hartshorne was doing, if he wanted to, we could call assemblage theory, about how we can describe the places in the world as unique comings together of lots and lots of different things that should be kept together. Assemblage theory is clearly what Hartshorne was up to in the 1930s, but in A New Philosophy of Society, titles like that, you know, A New Philosophy of Society, it's only about, I don't know, 150 pages long. Manuel de Landa elegantly outlines his approach to assemblage theory. He does this with reference to what we geographers might recognise as spaces and places at a range of scales, from the body to the nation state. De Landa's assemblage theory is an elegant addition to a long tradition of thinking of place in terms of a syncretic combination of diverse elements that form place through their relations in a particular locale. An assemblage, Galander tells us, is a unique whole whose properties emerge from the interactions between parts, which I think is more or less what Hartshorne said in the quote I showed earlier. The ways in which these parts are combined into an assemblage is not necessary or preordained, but contingent. Individual parts can be removed and become parts of other assemblages. Places are good examples. So my home is a place. It's made from red bricks, breeze blocks, terracotta tiles, window panes, copper wires, plastic outlets, wooden floorboards, cotton curtains, a stainless steel hob and oven, and a mortar and glue with all the things we eat and the notes on the fridge and all of it. This list could go on for a long time. Together, the full contents of this list makes up my house in Acton. The way that they are assembled makes my house different from a supermarket or a football stadium. And even in details, at least, different from other houses on the same street. It is an assemblage that's always changing. The food in the fridge is rarely the same as the day before. Cracks grow in the plaster. Weeds push out from between paving stones in the back garden. I could take out elements of this assemblage. I have for a while now considered removing the floorboards and putting in some new ones. The assemblage would remain despite the change in parts. It would still be my house. Galander's argument is that my house is a discrete thing. An assemblage made by the relation between parts and the kinds of things we do with those parts. The place as assemblage is made by the way the parts are connected. It's more than just a random collection of parts. It's a distinctive assemblage that makes it what it is, my house. All places can be thought of in this way. Central to Galander's notion of assemblage are two dimensions or axes, which he derives from Deleuze and Guattari. One axis concerns the role played by components of a whole. It is an axis that has expressive roles at one end and material roles at the other end. So it could be the same object, has some aspects of it which have a material impact on us. They're there. And on the other hand, they have an expressive, through code, through language and other kinds of things, impact on us. The second axis concerns the degree to which assemblages are stabilised around a coherent identity, or alternatively are destabilised and made unclear. In Galander's words, the former are referred to as processes of territorialisation, and the latter as processes of deterritorialisation. One and the same assemblage can have components working to stabilise its identity, as well as components forcing it to change, or even transforming it into a different assemblage. In fact, one and the same component may participate in both processes by exercising different sets of capacities. So if we return to the assemblage and place is my house, we can see that there are forces at work that stabilise its identity. These range from the laws that make it my property to the maintenance that's needed to stop it falling down. Meanwhile, there are the forces of deterritorialisation, the entropy that means it's always slowly falling down. Okay. Time to visit an assemblage, the place that was Maxwell Street, a place where I've lived vicariously for the last decade or so. Maxwell Street and the area around it played an important role in Chicago's history as a site of constant migration from Europe and from areas further east and south in the United States. Some have referred to it as the Ellis Island of the Midwest, due to the fact that for many immigrants to the city, it was their first port of call after arriving. In the 1920s, when one third of Chicago's population was foreign-born, the area around the intersection of Maxwell Street and Halsted Street, which is the ground zero of my project, was home to immigrants from at least a dozen nations. Originally, these included the German and Dutch populations fleeing persecution in Europe, but the area soon became the home to a large Jewish population by around the 1880s, who quickly established an informal market of peddlers' carts and open stalls selling everything from live chickens to tailored suits. In 1912, the market was officially recognised as Maxwell Street Market by the City Council. Beginning in the 1920s, Maxwell Street also experienced the arrival of African-American immigrants from the American South. And over the next decade, the area became an important centre of black culture in the United States, and is credited as being the birthplace of the urban electric blues, also known as the Chicago.